Major support for Louisiana Eats on WWNO provided by Zatarain's, proud producers of authentic New Orleans-style cuisine. Zatarain's, a New Orleans tradition since 1889.
From WWNO New Orleans, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. The condition of the world's fisheries is a topic that's inspired many books in recent years. On this week's Louisiana Eats, author Paul Greenberg shares some lessons he learned while researching his latest book, American Catch. Paul's book is aimed at an adult audience, as are most of Mark Kurlansky's award-winning works, but he writes children's books too. Mark reveals what inspired him to reach out to kids through his book, World Without Fish. Then, just as inshore shrimp season prepares to open, Shrimp Daddy's here to discuss one of our favorite foods. And Chef Gerard Maris teaches us the very best way to cook them up. We're looking globally and eating locally on this week's Louisiana Eats. Award-winning author Paul Greenberg's new book, American Catch, The Fight for Local Seafood, hits bookstores June 26th. Paul devoted years of research, some of it intensely personal, while writing this book. American Catch reveals some amazing facts about where your seafood comes from.
This book is another struggle, but it's really about local fish versus foreign fish. And right now, 90% of the seafood that we eat is coming from abroad.
Yeah, that's one of the biggest sins in the world. So yep. What are the fisheries that you examine this time?
Well, to begin with, I start where Mark Kurlansky left off. He's a big symbol of greatness to me, so I often pick up in his traces. But I look at the New York oyster, but more broadly, I look at the eastern oyster and what has become of it from New York north into New England. That's number one. Number two, I look at Gulf shrimp, or shrimp more broadly, both in Asia and in Louisiana. And then the final thing that I look at is salmon in Alaska. But whereas I looked at salmon in Alaska last time, more or less comparing it to farm salmon, in this case, I'm looking at this pristine, beautiful estuary called Bristol Bay that has the biggest sockeye salmon run in the world, you know, 40, 50 million fish.
Mm-hmm.
And they're about to put the continent's biggest copper mine right on top.
Mm-hmm.
So in each case, what I'm looking at, it's sort of like issue number one is an estuary that's kind of been destroyed, i.e. the Hudson River estuary, and might be coming back to life. Then I look at Greater Louisiana and the Mississippi estuary, an estuary that we know is in trouble, but it's still very vibrant, but it's being attacked from multiple fronts. And then finally, I look at an estuary that's pristine, abundant, beautiful, wonderful, and about to get hammered.
So, Paul, I remember when you first started coming down to Louisiana preparing to write this book. I remember at one time you were doing a crazy experiment on your own health with Gulf seafood. How did all that fold out?
Well, you know, so I just ate Gulf seafood continuously for a block of time, and then I had my blood tested. And true to form, really nothing was detected. There were no elevated PAHs. But that said, I then went back to a Canadian lab that does toxicology testing, and I had a very funny conversation with them. I said, you know, I'd like to repeat this experiment, but I'd like to do a real full workup, you know, because I feel like I might have missed some toxics that aren't on the normal testing spectrum.
Mm-hmm.
And this very nice Canadian man, he said, well, you know, if you're going to do that, you're going to have to dig a little deeper. And I was like, really? And he goes, yeah. I think we might need a flesh sample.
Oh.
A flesh sample? He goes, yeah, you might need a flesh sample. And I'm like, well, how big a flesh sample are we talking about? He goes, well, you're looking at an inch cubed. Does that sound fun?
Oh, my gosh. The lengths that you will go to for fish science.
Well, I have to say I demurred at that point. I thought it was good copy just to say an inch cubed. And leave it at that.
Amen. So shrimp really became your primary focus down here. And
yeah.
You allowed me to preview a draft of your shrimp chapter. And
yep.
I was particularly struck by this quote that Elaine Koritz of the Mangrove Action Project had said in a recent book on shrimp farming. It was an exotic species that destroyed local ecosystems, and it was solely for consumption by overweight people who don't need any more protein or cholesterol in their diet. So anyway, who is Elaine Koritz? What's the Mangrove Action Project? And what do you think about all that?
Well, so she was speaking specifically about farming of shrimp and specifically speaking about shrimp in relation to coastal wetlands in Vietnam, throughout Asia and South America, where shrimp has become this incredibly devastating thing. We've lost something like 3% of the world's mangrove forest globally over the last few years, and a lot of it is due to shrimp farming. So those numbers are pretty generally accepted, and the shrimp farming industry counters and says, you know, they're doing better and better. But I don't know. I mean, you know, it's hard. The interesting thing about Asia versus European or American seafood farmers is that there are just so many of them. There's so many small ones, big ones, diverse ones. And to try and enforce regulation on them is extremely difficult. But, you know, just to back up a second, when I quoted that book, it's a book called Let Them Eat Shrimp, and she quoted in the book. A pretty good book. But I was really referencing the effect of shrimp farming there. Wild shrimp has its problems, but in the chapter that I sent you and in the chapter that will eventually get published, I kind of look at wild shrimp versus farm shrimp and some of the trade-offs that are involved.
Well, I was fascinated by the story of the Mississippi River shrimp, something that, you know, I don't think I ever had a chance to taste, yeah. And one that you described as being, quote, the shrimp that Americans ate, a shrimp that swam right up the middle of our country into the very heart of our national culinary traditions.
Right.
What happened to the river shrimp?
Well, you know, it's funny. First of all, I stumbled upon the river shrimp myself. I was in the historic New Orleans collection, and it's funny when you go do a search for shrimp in the historic New Orleans collection, you get such a funny result. And I came across this book called Delphine, the Little Shrimp Girl, a story intensified by fate's miraculous doings from 1923. And what kind of tipped me off to how common river shrimp were was a line from this little book, and it said, Delphine is this poor river girl, and, you know, she lives in the sort of backwoods, and there's this one line, and she said, the tall, lean father, slow and unresponsive, tired with hard labor in the field, both his own and those of his neighboring planters, pulled his shrimp bags out of the Mississippi River where they had been hanging all night from the levee in the high water to find he had quite a catch. So we're not talking about shrimp trawling or offshore or whatever. This guy just hung some bags in the river and had them full of shrimp.
I had heard stories at one time of people who gathered river shrimp by coating bushes in cornmeal and running them along lines in the Mississippi River. And then they would pick up the bushes and shake them into the boat, and the little shrimp were hiding in there.
That's right. Well, they were quite abundant. What would happen to them, and this was another interesting moment for me, I met a wildlife biologist out of Vicksburg named Paul Hartfield, and Paul is a real specialist in kind of finding endangered species. What he told me is that this shrimp used to migrate from the mouth of the Mississippi all the way up the Ohio River. Now, of course, now there are dams on the Ohio, so they don't get up that far. So that's one thing that blocks them from going up that far and being as productive as they were. The other thing is that those of you down there know, you know, the Mississippi is a very different river than it was when Delphine the Little Shrimp Girl was fishing there.
The Army Corps of Engineers helped us again.
Yes, the Army Corps of Engineers did a tremendous intervention on the Mississippi. One of the things they did was to cut off oxbows in the river, straighten the river, and make the river much faster. Well, if you've got this shrimp that has to migrate upriver to Ohio, if the current velocity of the Mississippi changes significantly, how are you going to get up there?
Yeah, they can't swim like that.
They can't get up there. So, you know, just to set the record straight, the Mississippi River shrimp is not extinct. It's probably not even endangered. But as Paul Hartfield said to me, maybe once upon a time there might have been trillions of river shrimp. now we might have billions or millions. But, you know, it's these orders of magnitude that are always important moments in fisheries, right? You know, with fisheries, people always make the mistake of confusing seafood with land food or sea wildlife with land wildlife. You know, they'll say bluefin tuna is almost extinct. Well, there's still millions of bluefin tuna out there, but there used to be many, many more. What we're talking about is the loss of a food system when things become too rare to the point where they're called commercially extinct.
I see. Well, one of the most frightening projections that you're making, as far as I'm concerned, is that you believe it is possible that one day we might regard the shrimp in the Gulf of Mexico as so rare and odd as we do river shrimp.
Yeah, so, you know, it could happen. Of course, I'm being a little dramatic for effect, but my author's license. But basically what's happening is, many of your listeners know, we're losing Mississippi marsh at a tremendous rate. I've heard a Manhattan a year recently when I was down with people from the state looking at some of marshland reconstruction, that it's more like a third of a Manhattan a year. But whatever the case, you're losing a lot of marsh. Brown shrimp that you guys love so much rely on the marsh for rearing. They might be spawned out in the Gulf, but then they come inshore. They live in those little nooks and crannies. They depend on the marsh for protection, and also the marsh feeds them, you know, either through decaying organic matter or microorganisms or whatever. Anyway, there's an interesting phenomenon going on, which is the marsh is falling apart, and when the marsh falls apart, it creates more edge. Shrimp like the edge, and so they've been doing better as a result of having more edge. But at a certain point, so much marsh goes away that you lose all the edge. And at a certain point, you're going to have a very serious shrimp problem. So, you know, I applaud the state for trying to do what it can. I was just down there working. I'm working on a story right now about the hypoxia zone, you know, the dead zone, so-called dead zone.
Yeah.
And I was traveling around, went down to Sulphur Springs and saw one place where they were actually building marsh by pumping sediment out of the Mississippi into the marsh. And they actually created land. And that's interesting. You know, I'm not a scientist. I can't evaluate the long-term effect of it. What I can tell you is that I remember I was like staring at my iPhone, taking notes, walking around this new ground. And I was like, geez, is this new ground permanent? Is it going to support wildlife and shrimp? And just as I was typing that into my iPhone, I heard a and I looked up, and this giant cottonmouth had his mouth wide open and was about to bite me.
Oh, my gosh.
And I stepped back.
So it does support wildlife, but it's my understanding that when they create those sort of false islands or barrier islands, unless they plant it properly with mangroves and grasses, it's just going to wash away again anyway.
Well, it's controversial. I know that Eugene Turner and Nancy Rabelais, who've done work around this a little bit, have said that some of this marsh is so nutrient-rich from the silt that's coming off of the Mississippi that it doesn't encourage deep root growth, and so that it can wash away. The state vehemently disagrees with that. They do think that it can be a solution. You know, I don't know. I mean, you got to do something to kind of keep Louisiana wild.
Award-winning author Paul Greenberg and his new book, American Catch, The Fight for Local Seafood, available now for pre-order from your favorite independent bookseller. Should you devein your shrimp before serving them? We'll have an answer to that heated debate when we come back, so stay tuned. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen and Zatarain's. Here's this week's culinary quiz question, brought to you with support from Popeye's Louisiana Culinary Institute. Should you devein your shrimp before serving them? The truth is, deveining shrimp is a matter of aesthetics that depends on who's eating them. many cultures eat the whole shrimp, head, eyes, and all. There's no health danger in eating them with the vein as long as they're cooked. In Louisiana, if you're eating Gulf shrimp, as you should be, you probably serve and eat them whole just like your mother and grandmother did. Have you ever seen deveined shrimp poured out on a table at a shrimp boil? An even better question is, tail on or off when frying shrimp? I like to eat the crunchy shrimp tails, and the fried heads are delicious too. I'm Poppy Tooker, and no matter which way you cook them, fresh Gulf shrimp are real Louisiana eats. One of Louisiana's most important crops is harvested annually from the water, not the land. In 2012, Louisiana's harvest totaled over 49.6 million pounds of the sweet, delicious crustacean we all love, shrimp. Louis Rains has been part of the seafood scene here since 1990. Along the way, he's earned the name Shrimp Daddy. Louis, welcome to Louisiana Eats.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I'd like you to take us back to the start of your business and tell us how exactly you became Shrimp Daddy.
You know, it's even further back than 20 years. I mean, I've been fishing and hunting and that sort of thing all of my life. And I was just kind of around the seafood industry. My family is from Poitras area, and we have property in Delacroix. So I used to go down and go crabbing and shrimping and fishing and all that sort of thing. And I just got this idea that I wanted to kind of be in the seafood business. Nobody really steered me to it. I just kind of came up with this idea. So went down to the docks and bought some shrimp, and I started peddling them on the street to just some family and friends. And then it kind of blossomed.
So you were making home deliveries.
Home deliveries. That's how I started, yes.
And then what happened?
Well, I was doing that for a number of years, and I was able to make a living doing that. And then some of my customers kind of drugged me into some of the restaurants, and I didn't want to do that. I was really happy with what I was doing, and I was able to go fishing and have a pretty good life. Well, anyway, I started doing the restaurants, and then I just never really went back.
Have you been dealing with the same shrimpers, some of them, all this time?
Yes. A lot of the guys that I first started dealing with passed away. I mean, they were older trawlers and that sort of thing. But there's been a big transition over the last 20 years. I mean, our fleet went, it just changed. I mean, I would say the majority of the big boats in Louisiana are Vietnamese-owned now.
Yeah. What do you see as being the issue with why we're losing our shrimp fleets?
It's a lot of real hard work, and people, I'm not going to say, you know, most people, but a lot of people just really don't want to work that hard. Okay, and that's going to probably be the first thing.
It's a generational thing. Right. Often the next generation, they don't want to work that hard.
No, I mean, you have to really kind of get into it when you're really young and just kind of love it. Mm-hmm. You either love it or you hate it.
Yeah.
There's no, you know, in between. It's not just the hard work. The second aspect of it is the estuaries.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I know you talk about it a lot, but we have lost, you know, over one football field of land every 15 or 20 minutes to the Gulf. So basically, there's not a whole lot of land left between Grand Isle and Lafitte anymore.
Yeah, Delacroix hardly exists at all.
Exactly. And if you ride down there, it's just heartbreaking to see all those old oak trees dead because of the saltwater intrusion.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's mind-boggling what the federal government has allowed to happen to this state. So without the little estuaries and the little duck ponds and the land for the shrimp to come in and kind of lay their eggs in kind of a safe environment where, let's say, a shrimp lays a billion eggs, maybe the percentage of maybe 6 or 7% survival rate, now that it's just kind of open water, survival rate's going to go down even less to maybe 1%.
Because they needed all of those little nooks and crannies for nurseries.
Nurseries, exactly. And also they would feed off of all of the grass and all the different things that were floating around in the water.
Mm-hmm.
And they would, you know, probably grow about a half a size per week. So that is probably one of the biggest things that have hurt the shrimping industry.
Mm-hmm.
The price of fuel, the cost to put the boat together and that sort of thing has hurt a lot. And, of course, the foreign imports. You know, those guys are just kind of raping and pillaging rainforests and just digging shrimp ponds and contaminating the land and then moving on to the next project. And those shrimp farms have been probably the most detrimental thing to happen to the planet.
I agree. What do you see that shrimpers are doing now to help survive in the business?
Well, that's a really good question. The biggest thing that I've seen the shrimpers do is they don't go out and speculate anymore. They don't just like go out for a week at a time, load up the boat and just kind of fuel it up and go see what's going to happen. They just kind of work the moons and the tide tables. Like say you have a full moon and then that means that the tide's going to be coming and going faster at that moment. So they're going to probably work 3 days before the moon, and then 3 days afterwards. So they won't expend a lot of fuel. They can just kind of sit there in one spot, anchored, let the tide just kind of go through their nets. And that's pretty much that's what they all say. We just don't speculate anymore.
You know, I find that to be one of the very interesting things about the perception of our shrimp business and the reality of the shrimp business. Because there are a lot of people across the country who believe that shrimp trawls are ruining the environment. But exactly the way you described the lazy way that you can shrimp in Louisiana without expending fuel, you're also not fooling with the bottom or doing anything wrong for the environment, correct?
That is correct. I mean, a shrimper is nothing more than a farmer. And his plow is his boat with his net. And he goes back and forth, up and down, back and forth, up and down. It's very hard work and boring, and there's a lot of labor involved. But it is what it is. You know, a lot of these guys, they're struggling, and they have to actually have full-time jobs. So, again, they just kind of go out on the weekends, or they'll take a few days off in the middle of the week when they know the shrimp are going to be running. And that's how they have adapted to the cards that they've been dealt with.
I'm curious to hear your opinion about this. I personally feel that I would rather have an IQF shrimp, an individually quick frozen shrimp, rather than buying a fresh shrimp that I cannot be guaranteed is perhaps less than 72 hours out of the water. How do you feel about that?
I agree with you. There are a lot of people out there in the business, you know, that just kind of take an IQF shrimp and just thaw them out and pass them off as fresh shrimp all day long.
Mm-hmm.
It's not something that they should be doing, but it does.
They do that.
So if you take the IQF shrimp and they IQF it right on the boat, then they've basically just stopped the process of it decomposing, you know, the shelf life. You know, they could keep it 5 or 6, 7, 8 months in that condition, and you could thaw it out and it'll be almost as good as the shrimp that just came off the boat 72 hours, as you said.
And how about storing shrimp? How long will shrimp stay fresh, do you think? And do you have any suggestions for home cooks about how to treat them?
Let's say you get a cooler of shrimp, you know, and you want to hold them for a couple days. I mean, you can keep them in an ice water slushy environment for probably 7 days without really losing, you know, any of the quality, really. The head will start falling off and maybe kind of turning a blackish color.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not any – there's nothing wrong with that. There's just some sort of a – when it meets the air, something happens to it.
Mm-hmm.
But the quality, you know, is still there. It just doesn't look that pretty.
It's that slushy water that's really the trick.
Right. If you have shrimp that just came in from the boat 1 day old, they can't even peel those shrimp because they're too fresh. Just the shell won't release.
Yeah.
They have to let it sit 2 or 3 days before they can even peel them.
Yeah. Well, I want to say thank you so much for helping me debunk a lot of the mysteries and the myths about the shrimp business. And I hope you'll come back and talk to us again.
Absolutely. My pleasure.
Louis Raines, Louisiana's own Shrimp Daddy. current issue of Fine Cooking Magazine includes my definitive take on the history and how-to of New Orleans barbecued shrimp. Those folks at Fine Cooking test and retest each recipe before the magazine goes to print. Their test kitchens are in Connecticut, so occasionally I have to do a bit of cultural debate on what our traditional ways of cooking and eating shrimp are. Head-on shrimp with the vein intact made them a little nervous at first, but once they tasted them, our fresh Gulf shrimp served in that buttery, delicious barbecue sauce won them over. It's absolute fact that barbecued shrimp were invented in the 1950s at Pascal's Manali Restaurant. Their recipe is a secret, but said to contain nothing more than margarine, salt, and black pepper combined with large head-on shrimp cooked in a hot oven. My recipe has a few more ingredients, and I sauté them on the stovetop, but I think you'll be pleased with the results. Melt a half pound of sweet unsalted butter in a skillet. Add the peels and juice of a lemon, a couple of tablespoons of Worcestershire sauce, chopped garlic, bay leaves, sweet Hungarian paprika, cayenne pepper, fresh ground black pepper, and a generous amount of salt. Simmer it together over a low heat for 5 minutes. Then turn the heat up a bit, add the shrimp, and sauté them until they just begin to turn pink. Remove the pan from the heat and cover it. Let the shrimp marinate for about 15 minutes and give them a stir every 5 minutes or so to be sure they're all getting a good soaking in that delicious sauce. I serve mine in rimmed soup plates with plenty of hot French bread to soak up the sauce. For the recipe, pick up a copy of Fine Cooking Magazine on newsstands everywhere or visit our Louisiana Eats website at wwno.org and louisianaeatsradio.com. I'm Poppy Tooker, and barbecued shrimp are one of my favorite Louisiana eats.
Be Creole, gal who helped you come out on your shell.
What's the best way to boil shrimp? Chef Gerard Maris uses a reverse boil method that results in the best shrimp you've ever tasted.
Not very long ago, probably a year ago, a year and a half ago, I talked to another one of my favorite chefs, Kevin Vizard, and we were just chatting, and he was talking about what he calls a reverse method. And what he does is he makes a boil, and then he chills that boil down, gets it very, very cold. So I started doing that when I'm doing small amounts of shrimp, or I'm doing a salad, or I'm doing a remoulade, or I'm doing just marinated boiled shrimp. And what I do is I make this boil up, and I make my own recipe, but you could probably use the Zatarain's or whatever, and I get it very cold. And sometimes I'll actually freeze pint containers of it. After that, what you want to do is you want to boil your shrimp in salt water. As soon as they're done, being sure not to overcook them, you take them out and you chill them in that boil and let them sit for about 10 minutes, and that stops the cooking, and they start absorbing all that flavor.
You know, I think one of the mistakes people make when they're boiling shrimp is they overcook them.
Exactly.
So do you put the shrimp in the salted water and heat it to the boil, or do you plunge them into the boiling salted water?
I plunge them into the boiling water, and what I do is if you have like 5 pounds of shrimp, you don't want to add them all at one time. Add like a pound at a time and let it start. Let that heat remain. Let it keep on boiling. Once it barely comes up to a boil, you turn it off, let it set for a minute or two. It takes a very short amount of time. And then you strain them out, put them in that ice-cold boil, and let them sit for about 10 minutes. And then you can take them out and eat them immediately because they're chilled. And a lot of times what I'll do is I'll take them out, strain them, drizzle them with a little bit of olive oil, some crushed red pepper, and some fresh herbs, and use them on my salads.
Oh, that sounds delicious. Now, I think you told me recently that you've also started maybe having some blocks of this frozen boil.
Right. What I'll do is sometimes when I know I'm going to be boiling shrimp, and right now I'm seeing pickup trucks on the side of the road selling fresh shrimp, so that's a good sign. I'll go ahead and I'll make up a big batch of the boil, and I'll freeze up pint containers of it, and then I'll let it kind of partially thaw. And then when the shrimp come out of that hot salt water, go right in there, it chills them immediately, it stops the cooking, and it sucks up all that good flavor.
I bet that makes them easier to peel, too, doesn't it?
Well, you can do them peeled or unpeeled. I do them both ways. But if you're going to do a peeled shrimp, it's even better because the shrimp don't get a chance to overcook. They keep that nice texture. They're white. They're really refreshing tasting.
That's incredible. See, I always thought it was better to boil them in the peels with the heads on. That's what I'm always thinking. It's amazing to hear that you do it this other way. Now, Gerard, what do you think some of the most important things about boiling shrimp are?
Well, first of all, you have to have the absolutely freshest shrimp. And this time of year, that's very easy in Louisiana. You can pick them up at our local grocery stores. You can get them from fish markets. You can get them off the side of the road. But you want them absolutely fresh. You want to see behind that head that there's plenty of that coral orange color, just beautiful, firm shrimp.
You don't want them out the freezer then?
Ideally not. I mean, sometimes there are some good IQF products that are available in the off season, but right now there's no reason to buy those.
For those who might not know, what does that mean, IQF?
IQF is individually quick frozen. They're frozen immediately, and generally they're a very good product that we use in the off season. But in the season, the chefs are always using the fresh.
I've got one more question to ask you about that boil. Now, everybody has their own secret ingredients that they put into the boiling liquid. Would you give us a rundown of some of the flavors you like to include?
Well, I always use a little bit of salt. I like using black pepper. I use a moderate amount of cayenne, but I like the crushed red. And when I have jalapenos in the garden, I'll put a few jalapenos in there. But some of the things that I add that probably aren't as usual would be like whole cloves, allspice, and crushed fennel. And it gives it that interesting taste.
Well, thank you, Gerard. Thanks so much for taking time out from your busy life at the farm to chat with us.
You're more than welcome.
Chef Gerard Maris and his Louisiana boiled shrimp. When we come back, we'll visit the kitchen at G.W. Finn's with Chef Tenny Flynn. Don't go anywhere. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Rouse's Markets.
Ooh, yeah! All right! Ball seeds!
Chef Tenny Flynn knows good seafood. For over a decade at G.W. Finn's, Tenny and his partner, Gary Wallerman, have set the standard for quality seafood in a town that's been famous for its fin and shellfish for nearly 300 years. How do they do it? Well, let's find out. Tenny, welcome back to
Poppy.
Louisiana Eats.
How are you?
I am so glad to see you and to finally be here in your kitchen. How do you acquire all this seafood?
Well, we buy a lot. We buy everything whole, which is very unusual anymore. Most people buy fillets. And the first thing a cutter learns working for a wholesaler is you fillet the oldest fish you got.
Yeah.
And it takes a much more discerning eye to tell what the age and quality of a filleted fish, which, you know, you can witness by looking in your grocer's case usually, because that's what they buy.
Right.
So we buy whole fish, and we buy a lot, and we pay quick.
Well, understand that sometimes the fish doesn't even make it to the fish house. It comes to you straight off the boat.
Well, I mean, yeah, I mean, it certainly can. You know, it's kind of, and then we have to go out on the street and, you know, that sort of thing. You know, that's sort of an emergency situation. But, yeah, it has been known to happen. And then we've got, you know, one guy we buy crab meat from, one guy we buy shrimp from, you know, one guy we buy soft shells from. But the fish itself I buy from everybody in town that sells fish. And I do it over the phone in the morning, and my conversation is, what do you have that I want? And most of them have been dealing with them for, you know, 10 or 12 years, and they know not to just start reading me their inventory.
Yeah.
Because,
yeah.
You know, and it's like when I tell people that don't fall in love with one fish. You know, take a look at the recipe, take a look at the ingredients, and then go to the market and find the nicest fish that you can find there. And once you're there, you pick whatever the best-looking fish that is, and you base your menu around that rather than saying, you know, I want halibut, you know, because they've got halibut.
Right.
You know, they've got everything, you know.
And your menu is also very fluid to reflect seasonality, right?
Right. And, you know, what's available in the market, the seasonality of garnishes, you know, who's working that station on the line. Since I've only got two cooks cooking all the entrees, I can't overload, you know, one station at these, you know, because it all works together.
Yeah, you've got a pretty wild kitchen line here. How does it go when the restaurant's blowing and going out there?
It blows and goes. I mean, the on a busy night, you know, we serve 400 plus, and two cooks are cooking all those entrees, so there's not much precious food. You know, it's dishes that are designed to have three or four components. They have to come up and go out very quickly. As you can see, there are no heat lamps. There are no plate covers. Cooked food has to come from the grill to the plate, you know, to the guest.
So why is this seasonality thing important to your business model?
Well, it's 70% of our seafood that we menu here is out of the Gulf. If it's available, then it's in season. You know, the soft shell guy got me all excited today. But when he got down there, they had frozen the soft shells.
You want them waving their arms at you.
Well, I actually would rather have dead velvets. You know,
the
ones that die when they shed, they're so soft, they have no structure at all.
Oh.
If they're waving too vigorously, you know, they're getting hard again, usually.
Okay.
And the poor little things, you know, it's almost like you're putting them out of their misery. Because a blue crab will fight you. And all the soft shell wants to do is just hide, you know. So.
Well, let's not feel too sorry for the crabs right at this moment.
I don't at all.
Because they would eat us sooner than we would eat them if they had half a chance, right?
That's very true.
Well, the reason that I've been really dying to get our Louisiana Eats listeners into your kitchen here is because I understand you have all sorts of secret weapons over in your Fitch butchery area. Would you talk to us about what you've got over there?
You know, obviously it's not a very big kitchen. You know, a lot of places have a separate cut room. Either they dump, you know, a whole lot of air conditioning in there. You know, they run it down to about 60 degrees. So Randell Refrigeration came and wanted me to design a fish cutting table. And with their refrigeration technology, we came up with the idea of a refrigerated cut surface, which nobody had ever done before. So that kind of, it takes the place of having a separate room. There's a refrigerated rail. There are two refrigerated drawers that are very sizable. So I can put whole fish in a drawer, pull one up to the refrigerated board, cut a side off of it, you know, put that in the refrigerated rail, because the temperature integrity is absolutely the most important thing with fish handling. And that's whether you catch it yourself. And, you know, I'm sure you've seen people do it fishing. You know, they're out there butchering their trout in the hot sun and wondering why it's not any good the next day. For every 10 degrees over 32 degrees that a fish gets after it's harvested, the shelf life's cut in half. So, you know, 42 degrees is not really that hot. 52 degrees, still a little bit cold. 62 is getting up, you know, room temperature. You have to eat that fish the same day or it's not going to be any good. It's not a reversible process. So keep your fish cold all the time until it hits the pan. And I'm sure that you've eaten fish before it goes into rigor.
Oh, yes, indeed.
You know, and isn't that a totally different texture than after rigor comes and goes? And optimum shelf life is longer than some people realize. But that's handling things, you know, where you, like a bigger fish, you would have to, you know, kill it, gut it, pack the cavity with crushed ice, pack it in ice, and refrigerate it. If all fishermen did that, you know, the fish would last a very long time. But obviously, we have to get great fish to begin with. But once we do, we make sure it stays cold all the way down the line. You know, and we keep the portions in our 30-degree walk-in. Then we issue them small amounts at a time, so it stays cold all the way till it hits the grill.
Having that second special 30-degree walk-in just for your fish is another unique feature of your restaurant, isn't it?
Yeah, and that's the most important piece of equipment in the restaurant because, I mean, I don't even have to ice things down. You know, and I've certainly worked places where you had drain pans and you put ice on top and, you know, you'd come in the next day and the ice would be melted and there'd be this liquid in the bottom. And you know, it's a real luxury to be able to have a dedicated butcher box like that.
Most home chefs are not going to come close to having the kind of sophisticated equipment that you've got in this kitchen. So I know they're interested in putting the best taste in seafood on the table. And what can a home cook do to ensure that they're giving the best seafood to their friends?
Well, here we're lucky enough to either catch our fish or have friends that do. Just like I said, make sure it's cold. Take plenty of ice on the boat. When you're butchering, you know, don't do it in the sun. Leave all the fish in an ice chest and then have one at a time out on the board. Cut it and then immediately put those fillets on ice. You know, and people freeze trout, which I think is a terrible idea.
I agree.
You can, you know, put it in a Ziploc bag and put it in a bowl of ice in your refrigerator. It'll be good for 4 or 5 days. And then just eat it breakfast, lunch, and dinner till it's all gone. It does not thaw out very well.
No, it's never quite the same. So give it to your friends, give it to your family, and eat as much of it as you can while they're jumping in the boat. That's my philosophy.
Right.
Tenny, I want to thank you so much for letting us into the kitchen. You know, I've been dying to get down here. So thank you
so
much.
This is our 13th year, so, you know, I'm glad you made it.
That's my lucky number, so congratulations. Chef Tenny Flynn of G.W. Finn's Restaurant. New York Times bestselling author Mark Kurlansky is very concerned about the future of the world's oceans. His children's book, World Without Fish, is designed to enlist the next generation in the efforts to save our seas.
If we continued the way we're going and made no changes or adjustments whatsoever, it would happen and might happen alarmingly quickly. We are doing some things to try to turn it around with varying degrees of success. Basically, we have to stop taking more fish than the ocean produces. There are two basic principles of biology that you always have to understand this. And one is that for a species to survive, it has to have a large number of individuals. If it starts losing individuals and becomes a smaller population, at some point, and it's hard to say exactly what point, but at some point, there'll be too few of them for it to survive. And the other thing is that for a species to survive, there have to be a lot of other species around it. So when species start losing individuals, you're starting down a road which can lead to losing species, which can lead to losing more species. And if you continue doing that, eventually the whole thing will unravel and the oceans will go back 550 million years to the Cambrian Age when there was nothing but plankton and zooplankton.
Why did you decide to turn this into a children's book?
Because of a number of books that I've done, like Cod and The Last Fish Tale. I've traveled all over the country and actually all over the world talking about these issues, and I've talked to kids in schools, and I've also talked to adults. And I'm struck by how little people understand it. And kids in particular seem very interested and concerned about it, but don't understand it at all. And I thought somebody ought to just explain what's happening to the ocean, what would happen if it didn't get fixed, what people are doing to try to fix it, what's working, what's not, what you can do. I have a daughter who's 10, and I would give her each chapter after I finished it and ask her if there's anything in there she had trouble understanding. Or as she likes to say, she tried to keep me from being too boring. And when I finished with this whole process, I realized that I'd also done something that grown-ups need. So I think of it as kind of a family book, you know, like a family movie. It's a book that kids can read and their parents can read, and hopefully they can talk about it.
Mark, what do you hope will happen as a result of your new book, World Without Fish?
I hope that people will better understand the problem and become more actively concerned with what to do about it. It's kind of different for adults and kids. For kids, I just want to give them the information because they're ready to act. Kids really, they really want to do something and they just need more information. With adults, I think they need a little prodding to realize how serious it is. Isn't it interesting that kids so completely understand how serious all these problems, these bad things that are happening to the environment are? They just intuitively get it. grown-ups you kind of have to hit over the head for it to dawn on them.
Well, this grown-up certainly learned a whole lot from reading your book. Mark, how do you describe sustainable fishing?
I keep getting this question that indicates to me that people don't understand the word. All the time people ask me, well, if everybody ate sustainable fish, wouldn't we run out of them? No. Sustainable means a fishery that can go on forever because the amount of fish that they take doesn't exceed the amount of fish that the population produces. So you could fish this way forever and never have any decline in the fish population. And that's, you know, what our goal should be for all fisheries.
How do you believe the best guidelines for sustainability are created? Is it the job of the government?
I mean, the way it's set up now, it is the job of the government. But there are a number of better ideas out there, and one of them is the consumer. If people got well informed so they knew what a sustainable fishery was and which fisheries were sustainable, and then if they were able to get information about the fish that they bought so that they then only bought fish from sustainable fisheries, the whole thing could be regulated in the marketplace. There would be no market for abusive fisheries, and so they couldn't sell the stuff. They wouldn't fish like that. Fishermen all along have said that if you just let them manage the fishery, they could do a much better job than the government, which, you know, if you think of how government works, doesn't seem all that far-fetched. So there are experiments now in New England and in California where instead of giving all these regulations to fishermen, you just say, you form a group of fishermen, and you go to the fishery management people, and they say, okay, this year you can catch this amount of halibut, this amount of cod, this amount of tuna. It's up to you to figure out how to do it. And then you're monitored. And the fishermen decide, you know, if they want to throw back fish, if they want to cut down on their days of fishing, if they want to change their gear, however they want to do it.
Well, thank you, Mark, for coming to visit with us on Louisiana Eats.
My pleasure.
That's it for this week's edition of Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Join us next time as we celebrate Craft Beer Week.
I mean, you can't compare craft beer to wine, for instance. To have a great wine cellar, you got to be a very rich person. But you can have the best beers in the world in your house at a reasonable price. Beer is still beer.
Subscribe to our podcast, hear today's show, or catch up on previous editions anytime online at wwno.org and louisianaeatsradio.com. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Rouse's Markets, and Zatarain's. Our friends at Zatarain's are celebrating their 125th birthday with the world's largest crawfish boil. On Saturday, May 10th, from noon till 6 p.m., you can help them eat their way into the history books. 25,000 pounds of Louisiana crawfish will be boiled in New Orleans Champion Square. Learn more about this record-setting event at zatscrawfishboil.com. Additional support for Louisiana Eats is provided by Dickie Brennan and Company and Linda Green, the Yakaman Ladies Soul Food Catering. Our media sponsor is Louisiana Life Magazine, the magazine of a great state. Original theme music by Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes. Thanks to executive producer Thomas Walsh and sound engineer Joe Schreiner. I'm Poppy Tooker. We'll see you next time. Louisiana Eats is a production of WWNO and the University of New Orleans.